Happy New Year, and welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau, of Creighton University's Department of History. It was once the most famous night spot in America, as well as a symbol of the wonderfully colorful world of cafe society. The Stork Club closed decades ago, but its story is now told in a new book by New York Times reporter Ralph Blumenthal. Mr. Blumenthal will be joining us in a moment to talk about the Stork Club, but before we get to that, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. This week in 1959, revolutionary guerrilla forces under Fidel Castro toppled dictator Fulgencio Batista and established a communist government in Cuba. After graduating from the University of Havana with a law degree in 1950, Castro became active in the local Orthodoxo Party, which was dedicated to fiscal and social reform of the island nation. On March 10, 1952, Batista seized power, however, and canceled all reform efforts begun by Castro's party, making Castro determined to one day regain power. In July of the following year, Castro and his 26th of July movement attempted to topple Batista, but failed. Castro was captured and imprisoned. By May 1955, he was free once again and working closely with revolutionaries in Mexico to rally support for a second uprising. When that invasion faltered, Castro and 12 other men fled to the surrounding mountains where they built up sufficient peasant support to defeat Batista, which they did on New Year's Day, 1959. Turning to history in the news, while numerous monuments exist nationwide commemorating American men and women who have given their lives for freedom, none exist remembering another kind of war veteran, dogs. Recently, however, in the small town of Springwood, Illinois, a VFW post decided to construct a life-size bronze statue of a German Shepherd dog and its handler. According to VFW member Jose Palacios, he is alive today because of a dog handler and his canine during the Vietnam War. They gave their lives preventing Palacios and other soldiers from walking into a deadly trap. Nearly 4,000 dogs and 10,000 handlers served in the Vietnam conflict. British journalists and historians are reinvigorating a once comatose debate over the nature of Prime Minister Winston Churchill's diplomatic relationship with Adolf Hitler. According to journalist Frank Johnson, former editor of The Spectator, remarks made by Churchill to fellow cabinet members in 1940 call into question the popular picture of Churchill as an unyielding opponent of further appeasement of the Führer. In correspondence to cabinet members, Churchill remarked, "If we could get out of this jam by giving up Malta and Gibraltar and some African colonies, he, meaning Hitler, would jump at it." Historians Clyde Ponting and Andrew Roberts counter that this dialogue is merely an example of Churchill's brilliant political skills. At the time, they point out, Churchill realized that an economically and morally weakened England had to buy time with the German dictator who had already pushed the British government to the brink of collapse. You are listening to Talking History.
Chico-chico, das bolsas pra aqui. Chico-chico, tá comendo meu pomba. Chico-chico, gente que se alimenta. Não vai comer o mais melhor para o pomba. Chico-chico, chico-chico, das bolsas pra dentro aqui. Chico-chico, tá comendo meu pomba. Chico-chico, gente que se alimenta. Não vai comer o mais melhor para o pomba, mas por favor.
One contemporary described the Stork Club as symbolizing and epitomizing the deluxe upholstery of quintessentially urban existence. It means fame, it means wealth, and it means an elegant way of life among celebrated folk. Beneath its elegant surface, however, writes our guest today, there dwelled a decidedly less glamorous, even seamier side of life. Our guest is Ralph Blumenthal, who led a Pulitzer Prize-winning team at the New York Times and is the author of Stork Club, America's Most Famous Nightclub in the Lost World of Cafe Society, published by Little Brown. Welcome, Ralph.
Thank you, Brian.
Get us started for the benefit of those listeners who may not be familiar with the Stork Club or even with Cafe Society by giving us a brief history of both the club and cafe life in America.
Sure. The Stork Club opened during Prohibition in New York around 1929, at a time when, as Will Rogers said, Prohibition is better than no liquor at all. It opened as a speakeasy by Sherman Billingsley, a bootlegger from Oklahoma. And it lasted actually for a big, momentous chunk of 20th century history. It lasted until the age of Aquarius, the Vietnam era, 1965. and obviously flourished during the Depression, World War II, and we can talk about the reasons for that. But it took in this huge period of American history, and it became the place to be. People came from all over the country, and stars and millionaires and captains of industry made it their home away from home.
Obviously went through many changes in American society. You know.
It did, and it prospered during the bad times and succumbed at a time of post-war prosperity.
Good. Well, we'll want to talk about that, but first, your book it focuses on Sherman Billingsley, who's clearly a very interesting character. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, it's interesting. His family went west in a covered wagon from Kentucky to Oklahoma in the land rush of the 1880s. He was actually born in Enid, Oklahoma, in 1896, although he always claimed it was 1900. He liked to make himself 4 years younger, and he liked the idea of being born with the new century. But in one lifetime, you have the extraordinary prospect of a man whose family went west in a covered wagon and who ends up at the portals of, you know, the most gilded spot in New York well into the 20th century. So it's really a story of America. But Billingsley was a bootlegger who got a start in Oklahoma with his four brothers. At one point, they were the largest bootleggers in America. And they cut a swath from Oklahoma west to Washington State, through the Midwest, Nebraska, Michigan, and until they ended up in New York, where they opened up a bunch of drugstores, which was the perfect cover during Prohibition, because drugstores could legally get alcohol as medicine, and they converted that into booze for the speakeasies.
Well, clearly, the Stork Club wasn't a drugstore. You mentioned he opened it in 1929 and tied it into Prohibition here. What was the club like when it opened?
It opened in a small brownstone on West 58th Street, and he put a canopy over the sidewalk, which was interesting. It was a very brazen act for a speakeasy owner to do at a time when Prohibition agents were still raiding places. The club had music. It occupied several floors of this brownstone. One story I tell in the book, there was, of course, a lot of competition because in New York, as I said, in that era, you couldn't find a drink unless you walked 10 feet in any direction. There were plenty of other speakeasies, but Billingsley distinguished himself in various ways. One day, Heywood Bruin, the famous columnist for the Evening World, was out looking for a funeral he had to go to, and he passed the Stork Club, and it was so dark and unattended, he thought it was the funeral home. He walked in looking for the body and found a bar instead, illegally, of course, during Prohibition, that had some drinks, liked the drinks, invited his friends, and that gave the Stork Club a big push.
Was it simply because of Prohibition, or was it Prohibition, to reword that, that attracted people into the Stork Club?
Well, Billingsley was a master marketer, even in those days. He knew how to attract people to his place. He was totally devoted to his club, worked day and night. It was really the only thing that mattered to him, even more than the women he chased, and even more than the family he was also very devoted to. He sent the telegrams to stars in Hollywood inviting them to the Stork Club. He had coupons in the college newspapers for the young people to come in. He ended up putting the Stork logo on every possible product he could. He gave away liquor and ashtrays and suspenders and belts and pins and ties, all with the Stork Club image. So he was, you know, as I say, way ahead of the Nike swoosh in terms of self-marketing. And that was a real innovation.
Obviously, this self-marketing worked very well because he was able to survive the stock market crash and even Prohibition. But what was the Stork Club like after that, let's say, during the Depression years?
Well, he got raided in 1931, and he had to move. So he moved to another location, another brownstone, a townhouse on 51st Street. And that didn't turn out to be big enough. At the same time, he was fighting off some racketeers who had taken a big chunk of his business, and we can talk about that separately. But finally, he found the third location, which is the one people tend to remember, at 3 East 53rd Street, just off Fifth Avenue. And that was a doctor's office that he took over and eventually bought and built into the famous Stork Club. And that's the one you see in the movies with the canopy and the celebrities arriving in dark limousines. and that became the most famous one.
Well, you can't tease us like that and walk away from it. Tell us about the Racketeers.
Okay. Billingsley, he came to New York as this bootlegger I told you, and he opened up a restaurant with two pals from Oklahoma. He thought he knew them pretty well. Turned out he didn't know them very well at all. They sold their interest quietly to somebody else, who turned out to be a front for three of the Prohibition's biggest gangsters. One was Oney the Killer Madden, who had a piece of the Cotton Club. Another was Big Frenchie Demange, who was a old leg breaker from the West Side. And another was Big Bill Dwyer, who was a big Prohibition rum runner. And the three of them decided that they really owned the store club, and Billingsley was just his front, and he just could not get rid of them for the longest time. They siphoned money out of the store club. They made him the front in other clubs that they owned. He claimed he had no choice. Billingsley himself was kidnapped by Mad Dog Cole, the crazy young gunman, who himself was shot in a phone booth later, Billingsley did manage to pay out his partners and break away. And from all indications I found in my research, he did run the third and final store club on his own.
Interesting story. In the 1940s, he seems to have survived the Racketeers, and the store club becomes it's at its height of glory during the 40s in terms of attracting celebrities. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's interesting that during the war, the store club became an icon for America. Soldiers were fighting all over the globe, and they looked back on the store club as something they were fighting for in a strange way. The store logo was painted on bombers that flew missions over Germany. So American soldiers set up impromptu store clubs on Pacific Islands in Germany. Because it was an image of home. And when they came home on leave, and even the commanders of the war, famous admirals and generals, would stop at the store club for a drink, and they would sometimes diagram their military strategies on the tablecloths. And there was a doorman who was very concerned about this because he thought that when the tablecloths were sent to a Chinese laundry, it could fall into the hands of the enemy. So he would throw out these valuable tablecloths. But it became a sort of a symbol of America, and you might think that the people fighting in foreign, horrible foreign theaters of war would resent the fact that there was a place back home where people were dancing and having a good time, but it seemed to be the contrary. They look back on that as one of the things they were fighting to save.
During the 50s and 60s, though, or actually probably during the 50s after the war, it really became a mecca for celebrities. Now, why would celebrities find...
Well, remember that television was in its very early stages, so there was really no virtual... There was no virtual reality except maybe radio and movies, but reality was reality in those days. If you wanted to see somebody, you had to see them face-to-face. And celebrities wanted to be seen most of all. They didn't so much want to see other people. They wanted people to see them. So they went to a place where they knew they would meet other celebrities, and that was the store club. Also, people from all over the country, visitors, did get into the store club to ogle the celebrities. But it was sort of a giant meeting ground for the famous, and it just fed on itself. And there was no entertainment to speak of. There was dancing in the big room, but aside from orchestras that just followed each other in quick succession, there were no chorus girls, there were no singers. It was just a place for people to see each other and be famous.
So why did it not survive, to use your phrase, the age of Aquarius?
Well, first of all, television was a big blow. People were not going out at night so much. I mean, they were staying home and watching their flickering little black and white screens. This was quite a sensation. The growth of the suburbs had people working in town and then, fleeing the city at the end of the day, getting on their buses and trains, so they weren't going to be around to go to a nightclub in the evening. The leisure class that the store club depended on faded. Democratization had come in. People were the usual... the long-term divisions of society were being erased, so there wasn't this privileged class that would go to the store club and everybody else would have to work. It succumbed to the time, really. And ever since then, they've only been pale imitations. I mean, Studio 54 might have come the closest later, but there really has been no place like it since.
Okay. Now, you mentioned in your book, in talking about the demise of the Stuart Club, union problems and problems of race. You want to just talk about those a bit?
Yeah, Billingsley had an uneasy relationship with the unions ever since he opened up the first Stuart Club, and Dutch Schultz, the beer baron and big prohibition gangster, tried to muscle in on him with his corrupt restaurant unions. And Billingsley threw those racketeers out and always was bedeviled by labor problems, even when the union movement changed and unions became more honest and the corruption was controlled. He always had a vision of the unions as crooked. He paid his workers well enough, he thought, and they didn't need to join a union to make money. But when you know, when the rest of the country organized and labor unions became de rigueur, they still couldn't get into the Stuart Club. So he was always being struck, and he had these running battles with unions. They would picket him, and he would go up on the roof of the Stuart Club and bomb them with bags of water, which was not calculated to lead to a solution. He also bugged the Stuart Club with microphones so he could listen to the staff plotting against him, which they did, and listen to his guests. And that's one of the revelations in the book, that the Stuart Club was bugged with hidden microphones and two-way mirrors, and Billingsley listened on the internal phone lines. The labor problems really killed him at the end, because a strike started in 1957 that never ended. Despite court rulings he won, they never stopped picketing him, and people just stopped going through the picket line. So that was one big nail in the coffin of the Stuart Club. The other was race. Remember, in America before the Civil Rights Revolution, blacks had trouble getting into not only the Stuart Club, but nightclubs in general, the best restaurants, medical schools, colleges, country clubs, golf clubs. This was a very different era, and obviously a very sad chapter in American life, but the Stuart Club was by no means unique. The particular problem that occurred in 1951 was that Josephine Baker, the flamboyant dancer and singer, came to the Stuart Club with some friends. Was not promptly served, claimed she'd been snubbed, and stormed out and charged discrimination. In my book, I go into a great bit of detail laying out this episode. It's not the way it's been handed down by history. It was much more complicated than that. We don't really know what happened that night. Josephine may have gone with an agenda, seems so. But either way, the historical truth is inescapable. These clubs were not hospitable to black Americans. And when that story got out, it proved, again, another nail in the Stuart Club's coffin, and it could never escape the taint of racism.
In the minute we have left, the Stuart Club was actually featured, or at least became part of, a number of Hollywood films. Maybe you could identify one of those and tell us how it was represented.
Sure. The most famous one is All About Eve with Bette Davis, which is set, a lot of scenes are set in the Stuart Club. Bette Davis and Celeste Holm. It's a very good picture of the Stuart Club. You really see it from the inside. Another is The Wrong Man, an Alfred Hitchcock movie with Henry Fonda, based on an actual case of a bass player at the Stuart Club who was accused as a robber, misidentified by witnesses, and goes through hell before he's acquitted. It also figured in a movie, a very charming little musical called The Stuart Club with Betty Hutton and Barry Fitzgerald. She's a hat check girl and saves the life of a millionaire, and not realizing he is a millionaire, gets him a job as a busboy in the Stuart Club. It's very funny, lovely music. It's another indication of how the Stuart Club became such an icon for popular culture, and it's been used as backdrops in many other films.
Well, it's a fascinating history of a very different era and an icon of that era. So we're out of time, however, so thank you for joining us, and I hope you'll come back again soon.
I'd love to, Brian. Thank you.
You've been listening to Ralph Blumenthal, author of Stuart Club, America's Most Famous Night Spot in the Lost World of Cafe Society. This is Talking History.
That this heart of mine embraces all.
past New Year's, most people celebrated not only a new year, but the first year of the new millennium. Well, historians and those entrusted with keeping the calendar beg to differ then, and they continue to do so this year. Here to set us all straight, giving us an excuse to celebrate the new millennium all over again, is Robin Catchpole. Catchpole is senior astronomer of the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, England.
To find out why the third millennium and the 21st century only start at midnight on the 31st of December 2000, which is also the start of the year 2001, we have to go back almost 1,500 years. Early in the 6th century AD, a monk and astronomer called Dionysius Exiguus, which can be translated as Denis the Little, was living in what is now southwest Russia. He was making a table of dates for Easter and decided to have a new system for naming and counting years based on the birth of Christ rather than the reign of the Roman Emperor. This meant that Dionysius's current year, 248 of the Emperor Diocletian, would in future be known as the year 532 AD. His system was based on the idea that Christ was born on the 25th of December of the year preceding the start of the year 1 AD. In other words, there was no year zero in his system. This was hardly surprising because the concept of zero as a number would not be introduced into Europe for another few hundred years. The lack of a year zero is the reason that we celebrate the start of the next millennium at the end of the year 2000 and not at the beginning. It's easy to see why. The first year of the Christian era was named year one, but 1 year of time had only elapsed since the start of the era at the end of year one. Similarly, an interval of 2,000 years will only have elapsed at the end of the year 2000 and not at the start. The identical problem of when the new century begins came up at the beginning of the 19th and 20th centuries. On both previous occasions, the newspapers were almost unanimous that the new century began at the start of 1801 and 1901. So this is the first time in over 200 years that ignorance has prevailed and the majority of the world celebrated the start of the year 2000 rather than the end of the year as the start of the third millennium and the 21st century. Needless to say, we at Greenwich will be celebrating the start of the year 2001 and go even further and claim that the true millennium starts at naught hours Greenwich Mean Time on the 1st of January 2001. Our claim that the correct moment is naught hours Greenwich Mean Time is based on a conference in Washington in 1884 that adopted Greenwich Mean Time, or GMT, as the universal time for all the world.
You've been listening to Robin Catchpole, senior astronomer of the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, England, and this is Talking History. Historic Club provided one form of entertainment. Here to tell you about a museum devoted to another type of entertainment, said to be the product of the world's oldest profession, is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
In Butte, Montana, there is a museum that explores the history of prostitution. Its setting is a 43-room Victorian building that was once a brothel known as the Dumas that opened in 1890. It may be the only place in the world written up by both Penthouse Magazine and Civilization, the Library of Congress magazine. Butte, Montana was once a bustling mining town that boasted a population of more than 100,000. Today, only 35,000 people live in the area. The mines that supported the town closed in 1983, the year after the Dumas closed its doors.
And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, we call to your attention a major television event. Jazz music objectifies America, says trumpeter Wynton Marsalis at the outset of Ken Burns' new documentary. It is an art form that can give us a painless way of understanding ourselves. In the hands of the acclaimed filmmaker Ken Burns, Jazz, a 10-part series airing on PBS beginning January 8th, is a journey across an American landscape divided by war, segregated by race, united through swing and dance and ultimately redeemed through this most American of art forms. Jazz is much more than a study of this extraordinary American music, Burns says. It offers a precise prism through which so much of American history can be seen. With 75 interviews, more than 500 pieces of music, 2,400 stills, and over 2,000 archival film clips, the series follows the growth and development of jazz through the 20th century, as well as the stories of its legendary figures. Be sure to check your local listings for exact dates and showtimes. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you will join us next week when we will take a look at the history of the cinema classic James Bond. Until next time, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. From the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.